Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where we're joined by Dr. Jesse Norman from Britain. I'll introduce him briefly. He's the Conservative Member for Hereford and South Hampshire since 2010, currently the British Minister for Roads, but he's here in his capacity as the author of Edmund Burke, The Visionary Who Invented Modern Politics, this book, and he's soon to be the author in July of Adam Smith, What He Thought and Why It Matters. So two significant books on British philosophers and commentators, Burke and Smith. And tonight, Dr. Norman's going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic of reflections on Edmund Burke. And before I do so, I should say thanks to the Australian Catholic University, who brought our speaker to Australia in order to give the PM Glynn lecture, which he did in Sydney on Monday. But tonight, it's the Sydney Institute. Many thanks.
Thank you very much indeed, Gerard, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for coming. What an absolute delight it is to be here at the Sydney Institute and in front of a packed sellout crowd. Even better. So thank you very much indeed for that. It's also a huge pleasure for me to be here, as Gerard has said, as the guest of the Australian Catholic University and of the PM Glynn Institute. And if you haven't visited Institute event or read some of their papers or work, I absolutely encourage you to do that, because they're doing some wonderfully interesting stuff and well worthy of the attention of any person in this room or indeed outside it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. It's a great delight for me also to be here to speak to you about one of my great heroes, Edmund Burke. As you will be aware, today we seem to be living in an age of revolutions and worries about the disintegration of society and the zeal of some of these new revolutionary ideas. And I just thought it might be interesting to talk a little bit about revolutions and, as it were, the constitutional systems that they are proposing to revolutionize. Luckily, my topic of reflections on Edmund Burke is so wide, I can more or less say what I like. And so hopefully this will fit within that ample compass. Ladies and gentlemen, today is, as I think it's fair to say, not regarded widely as such, but nevertheless it is an age of revolutions. According to that impeccable scholarly resource, Wikipedia, between 40 and 50 rebellions and revolutions have occurred worldwide since the year 2010 alone. And they include the Arab Spring, numerous events in Syria, Yemen, Sudan, South Sudan, Iraq, Ukraine, Egypt, and a failed coup d'etat in Turkey. Now, I've been invited to offer some reflections on Burke, and I just thought that rather than make a political speech, and I'm not here as a politician, I'm not here let alone as a minister, just as someone who tries to think about philosophical issues and political issues and historical issues, I thought I'd try and just ruminate a little bit on that. And if I may, I'd like to start by, if I may, just painting a picture for you of a particular moment, a government under siege, major international issues of the day, a sense of economic crisis, serious religious unrest, domestic political convulsions. Of course, could be describing any number of countries today, but I'm actually describing Britain in the 1760s, a decade in which my country had not one, not two, but six different prime ministers, in which it laid the foundation for the loss of the American colonies with the Stamp Act, and other tax measures, and struggled to pay off the debt that it had accumulated in the First World War, that is, the Seven Years' War, of 1756 to 1763, all of which just goes to show that there is nothing new under the sun. And of course, it seems to be the fate of every generation to think of its own issues as entirely new and without precedent. Of course, general elections in those days, of which there were many in the 1760s, were rather different from what they are today. At a very minimum, voters expected to be lavishly wined and dined, or treated, as it was called, by the different candidates. Now, treating in Britain remains an electoral offence. At one time, a few years ago, an allegation of treating was made against me during a general election on the grounds that I was supposed to have bribed the electorate with an offer of chocolate cakes. But as you will know, ladies and gentlemen, as the members of the Sydney Institute would instantly understand with their ample knowledge of British history and law, treating, although an electoral offence, is only an electoral offence if either alcohol or meat is involved. It's an oddity of English law that vegetarians and teetotalers cannot be treated. In the 18th century, however, let me tell you, things were very different. Indeed, treating was endemic, and since elections often took weeks to conclude, the cost could be ruinous. In fighting for the seat of Chester in the year 1784, the Grosvenor family paid for, we know this because we have the receipts, 1,187 barrels of ale, 3,756 gallons of rum and brandy, and over 27,000 bottles of wine. These were pretty heroic numbers for a seat with just 1,500 votes. I make that about 3/4 of a barrel of ale each, just under 2 gallons of rum and brandy each, and something like 15 bottles of wine. Now, Edmund Burke was elected to Parliament in 1765 at the height of the furore over the ultimately colony-losing Stamp Act, a tax on the colonies which had infuriated opinion in America. And before we proceed, let me say a word or two of introduction to the great man. He was born in Dublin in 1730. He had a Protestant father and a Catholic mother from Cork, indeed from a Jacobite family. And that mixed religious parentage and his own upbringing, which included education with the Quakers, gave him an astonishing awareness of different strands of religious reflection and practice. He then went from Dublin to from school to Trinity College Dublin. He went to the Middle Temple, which he absolutely hated, and he decided to make his way as a writer and as a reviewer and as a literary figure at a time when this was just beginning to open up as a possible line to any kind of living. Defoe had laid a trail. Johnson, as an independent literary figure, had, of course, blazed a path. And Burke himself followed in those steps. And then, by an astonishing double leap, managed to move not merely into Parliament in 1765, but also into the role of being secretary to the Prime Minister. Astonishing thing. And, of course, as an MP, at a time when your oratory made a huge difference, was itself a projection of political power and authority, he made a remarkable impression on the House of Commons. It was said at the time, an Irishman, one Mr. Burke, is sprung up in the House of Commons who has astonished everybody with the power of his eloquence, his comprehensive knowledge in all our exterior and interior politics and commercial interests. He wants nothing but that sort of dignity annexed to rank and property in England to make him the most considerable man in the lower house. And of course, it was precisely that property aspect that was to dog him, because of course bought a large property outside Beaconsfield in an effort to, as an act again of kind of political power, and remained in debt as a result for the rest of his life. And unfortunately, he was too honest to take the normal kind of bribes and financial inducements that could have been used to pay off the debt, especially when he was Paymaster General, which was a role which entitled you to take a little bit of vigorish on all the pay to the armed forces, and therefore had been a colossal source of revenue to some of his predecessors. Burke was not merely a supreme orator, he was also a supreme prose stylist. And the two come together in a marvellous quotation of James Boswell's, where he says of Burke in the House, he says, "It was astonishing how all kinds of figures of speech crowded upon him. He was like a man in an orchard where boughs loaded with fruit hung around him, and he pulled apples as fast as he pleased and pelted the ministry." Now, Burke's talents were instantly recognisable and were immediately recognised. He was a very close friend of Joshua Reynolds, and when Reynolds set up the club, Dr. Johnson's club, in order to provide some amusement for the great man, who was subject to periodic fits of depression, Burke was the first person he chose beyond himself and Johnson as a form of company and entertainment. And of course the club in due course was to amass possibly the most intergalactic array of talent ever assembled in one place, including not just Johnson and Reynolds and Burke, but also David Garrick, Oliver Goldsmith, Adam Smith, David Hume, and Edward Gibbon. And Burke spent the next 30 years of his life fighting injustice in England, in Ireland, in the American colonies, in India, and of course the injustice of the mob during the French Revolution, giving some of the most memorable speeches in the English language and writing a series of works which I think establish him as the greatest philosopher statesman of the past 300 years. But life was not straightforward for him by any means at any point, and he was often accused of inconsistency, dishonesty, and even treachery in relation to the American and the French revolutions. Burke was a supporter of the American colonists, and he was a very vigorous opponent of the revolutionaries in the French Revolution. And even during his own time, there arose a myth that he was a lickspittle, a creature of the great Whig aristocrats, worse, a turncoat, a traitor to progressive causes, because he'd supported the American colonists and yet bitterly opposed the revolutionaries in France. Now, we can say now, with certainty, that these claims are false. And I would suggest that there's a strong contrast with what we now know about Thomas Paine, author of Common Sense, author of The Rights of Man, his most vigorous, in many ways, his most vigorous detractor. Paine was a brilliant journalist, but he was a moral intellectual charlatan, a man who had petitioned Burke's friendship, been taken up by Burke and supported by Burke, only to turn on him in the most slanderous and dishonourable way. And in particular through the allegation, which he knew to be false, that Burke was in receipt of a private masked or secret pension during the latter part of his life. Paine was a man who knew the greatest men of his era, George Washington, Lafayette, the whole of English society, and retained the affection and the admiration of none of them. There was one famous moment where he escaped or was released from the Bastille, having made his way to Paris after the commencement of the French Revolution, and let out in a dreadful state and taken in by a man called Bonneville for a week's R&R, and this being Paine, stayed for 5 years. There's also an intellectual mistake at the centre of the charge against Burke, and this is essentially the thrust of what I want to reflect on today. This is the idea that all reflections are basically the same. That is, that there is some they are only an expression of a fundamental human desire for freedom and autonomy and a yearning to throw off the shackles of society. If you take that view, then it's very easy to fall into the idea that Burke was inconsistent in supporting the American colonists and bitterly opposing the Jacobins. But I think it is wrong. In fact, Burke accepted or supported not one, but at least five separate rebellions against authority during his lifetime. The Glorious Revolution of 1688, not during his lifetime, but the inheritance of which was felt then. The rights of the colonists in the American War of Independence. The Corsicans' struggle for freedom after their country was sold to the French in 1764. The War of the Bar Confederation, by which the Poles sought to eject the Russians from the Commonwealth after 1768 and several revolts against the East India Company under Warren Hastings in India. And in every case, he is supporting the underdog. In every case, he is supporting what is essentially a collective uprising against the imposition of some arbitrary and oppressive innovation in the name of existing liberties and established custom. Each society or community, for him, is seeking to preserve its social order and its way of life, and he is supporting that position. So the revolution in America comes about in reaction to specific grievances and specific claims of right over taxation, a wrongful and arbitrary assertion of power by the British government, resisted by the revolutionaries, at root a conflict over a specific conception of English liberty. As he says in his speech on conciliation, the colonists are not only devoted to liberty, but to liberty according to English ideas and on English principles. Abstract liberty, like other mere abstractions, is not to be found. Liberty inheres in some sensible object. It's the specific rights of English common law as refracted through legal practice that he is defending against this arbitrary imposition. And when people start to use abstractions, when they go to abstract nouns, it's always a Burkean view that you are, some charlatanry is being practiced. Your pocket is being picked intellectually when that happens. I ask you whether that ever happens these days in your experience of contemporary politics. The conflict in France was very different. It did not seek the redress of specific grievances as such. It involved a wrongful and arbitrary association of power by the revolutionaries through mob disorder and violence. It was an uprising conducted not to defend an existing way of life, but in the name of abstract universal rights, slogans whose true meaning was unclear and uncertain. As Burke noted in one of his early works, this resort to abstractions is always an appeal to the emotions and not to the reason. The revolution in France led from the outset to a wholesale destruction of French institutions, including the monarchy, much of the aristocracy, and much private property. Although, of course, property rights were specifically supposed to be defended as natural and imprescriptible in Article 2 of the French Declaration of the Rights of Man. It expropriated and nationalised the lands of the church, and it took place just 22 miles away from English soil, posing by its force and example a grave threat, a contagion, as it was seen, to Britain herself. It was, in that sense, a true and total revolution. Now, John Locke had taught that civil government depends on the consent of the governed, and that the governed have a right of revolution against tyranny or the abuse of power. Burke takes a different and more nuanced view. There is a distinction between rebellion for him and total revolution. And indeed, the pre-modern conception was this idea of a literal revolution, a turning of the wheel of life found in cosmology or science or reflection on the seasons. It's that turning of the wheel which restores what exists before and allows new growth. Burke's idea is very different. It is one of a violent and rapid upheaval which engulfs not merely politicians and constitution, but the whole of society, obliterating what is there before. And that is, I would suggest, the sense, the modern sense, of which we think of revolution. Now, Burke was famous in his own time for his almost instant recognition that the revolution in France was one of these total and all-engulfing convulsions. And this has created a puzzle for historians, especially to those who are wedded to a conception of history as a series of contingent events governed by no patterns or laws. Surely Burke was no prophet, he was just lucky in this expectation. I would suggest that we just need to look at the facts to realise why that is wrong, and then join a few dots and we'll come up with a different view. Burke's had a reputation as a man of astonishing political foresight who had predicted the course of the revolution even through to the emergence of Napoleon several years after his own death in 1797. And I suggest to you that he was able to know this through a remarkable combination of exact knowledge, historical understanding, and moral imagination. At that time, bien-pensant English intellectual opinion was that the revolution in France would be a revolution like 1688. There would be a modest change from which a constitutional regime, constitutional monarchy, would emerge, as it had done nearly 100 years earlier in 1688. But Burke saw it very differently. He'd seen mob rule firsthand because there had been anti-Catholic riots, the Gordon riots in 1780, in which mobs had roamed the streets of London, destroying Catholic property, raiding distilleries, releasing prisoners from Newgate Jail, and making a sustained attempt to capture the Bank of England. People forget this. Burke had drawn his sword in order to defend himself against the mob in 1780. And of course, his historical understanding instantly goes not just to that, but to another great convulsion in British history, and that, of course, is 1641 and the outbreak of the Civil War. Now, if we read Burke closely, we can see that even from early on in his career, he has a sensitized understanding of what revolution, what social disintegration might entail. He takes certain things to be the marks of a society potentially slipping from order into disorder and decay. They included disrespect for legitimate public authority, attacks on private property, economic weakness, the erosion of religion, a yearning to ignore inconvenient facts and rush to judgment, the loss of a sense of history. And there are linguistic and conceptual changes, a debasing of language, a worship of abstract nouns I've mentioned, appeals to a mythical and utopian state of nature, a desire to abolish existing institutions and to begin again. Above all, a move from respectful disagreement with opponents who are recognised as equals in a conversation to personal contempt for them and the public denigration and denunciation of them as enemies of society. The ultimate result of these trends can only be the supersession of politics or peaceful exchange and the reconciliation of views by violence. Now, I suggest to you, I don't want to be apocalyptic about this, but I suggest to you that it's not hard to see some of these things beginning to emerge in some of our societies today. In Britain, at least, I can't speak for Australia, we see some of the same public denigration and contempt. We do not see the language of political engagement and respect. We see public denunciation of the other as a kind of hated despised opposition. There is no interest to understand the other's point of view, their motivations or values, or any of the detail of their ideas, for to understand might in due course lead to sympathy or respect, or even a feeling of warmth. And I would suggest that social media, which allow anonymous comment, concatenating very quickly, building up, ebbing and flowing, which allow increasing tribalism as social media, as it were, encourage people to link with those they already know and like, and in some cases nudge them to do so. I'd suggest that social media have a lot to answer for in this regard, as well as some of the specific concerns that people have about their effects on young people and on the vulnerable. So then what can we do? I want to suggest to you that we must make the case once more for decency, for mutual respect, and for the institutions of representative government. I take those to be the foundations of our society. What does that mean? I think it means recognizing the possibility of social disintegration for what it is, recognizing even the possibility of revolution in some contexts, seeing these signs of coarsening in our public discourse, signs of linguistic decay, discourtesy, labeling, tribalism, and the like. Secondly, I think it means every generation must take vigorous steps to identify and to dispel some of the myths that underlie this radicalism and the ignorance from which they often spring. Just take the French Revolution itself. Astonishing public ignorance of what it actually was and its effects. The French Revolution was expected to end privilege, destroy elites, enfranchise the poor, and break the power of the church. In fact, it did none of these things. It led to violence, bloodshed, anarchy, terror, civil, and then international war at the cost of hundreds of thousands of lives. In many ways, it was an utter catastrophe. Similarly, the Cuban Revolution has massively impoverished that country. Communism nearly destroyed the economies and societies of Eastern Europe. These things are not merely facts of our recent history. They must be living facts understood by people who wish to preserve the social order and the benefits, the freedoms with which we are currently blessed. And thirdly, I think this places on us all to a duty to understand and to celebrate the institutions that make each country special in its own way. And for Britain, and I think for this country, notably the rule of law and the historical traditions that have led to the civilized polity that is Australia as it is Britain. Now, in Britain, people forget that the fundamental constitutional principle is not one of popular sovereignty at all. Britain has never had popular sovereignty. It is it is governed by parliamentary sovereignty. Parliament is a deliberative assembly, as Burke reminds us, not an assemblage of people's delegates. It is Parliament that represents, distills, debates, constrains, and ultimately balances the different views and interests in societies. Statutes, laws, are not directives handed down from a sovereign power to the people. They are agreements negotiated between, in our case, the monarch, the lords, and the commons. That is created by the nation for itself. And pure majority rule is inevitably, in a Burkean conception, arbitrary rule, because it is unconstrained and breaches the fundamental principle that no group, no person, should be judged in their own cause. And of course, effective government must take into account not merely the institutions of the constitution itself, but a wider constitutional temperament that understands and works with the tenor and the temper of the people. If you see it from that perspective, then democracy, in the 18th century sense, is the direct and unbounded expression of the popular will. In that sense, Burke is no democrat. But in another sense, he insists that power must be accountable. It must be exercised publicly at all levels on behalf of the people. And these are strikingly modern, indeed democratic thoughts. If you think of democracy not merely as a matter of the extension of the vote, or indeed of the minority protections implicit in a constitutional arrangement, but as it, in its original conception, that is to say, the possibility of a government being changed following a general election as a result of that, then Britain at least has had democratic government or something similar to it since the 1760s. Now, the irony is that ever since Burke, it has been the existence of political parties and the capacity of a nation to change its government after a general election that have been taken as the true emblems of democracy. When we look at other countries, it's the absence of political parties that is always, I think, a sign of a state that is either totalitarian or at risk of totalitarianism. In this sense, my country, of Britain, has given something through Burke, I think, of enormous importance to the world. And I think it's important for us to remember that, to understand it in all its complexity and with all its defects. And that tradition of parliamentary government, the duties of the representative, canonical statement of the centrality to our political discourse of political parties, their role as the recruiters of talent, as the distillers of opinion, of the balancers of interest across a country, and in Britain at least, their capacity to channel political debate and to prevent merely factional legislative processes. I think these are enormously important achievements. Burke, as their advocate, as their first analyst, and as their greatest promoter, is, I think, the hinge, therefore, of modern political and indeed democratic thought, just as, and I hope to show this in July, Adam Smith is the hinge of modern economics, because he places markets at their centre. And in that sense, I think those two, friends as they were, are two great heroes, not just of their time, but of ours. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much to Dr. Jesse Norman. As I said, we've got copies of Edmund Burke, Philosopher, Politician, Prophet, available after, and I'm sure our speaker will be happy to sign a copy. So we come to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than the top of the hour, and as usual, questions should be broadly on the topic, with the emphasis on broadly, I think. So can I take you back to where your book starts? You've spoken about Burke's attitude to the French Revolution and to other revolutions. Mm. Your book starts with Jonathan Swift's 1730 essay, a brilliant essay, a modest proposal, and focusing on British and Ireland. You can't say, of course, what Burke would have said about 1916 in Dublin. No one has any idea. But when Burke was around, what was his proposal for the interaction between Britain or England and Ireland? What was his thinking about that?
Well, of course, Ireland was in name a kingdom, but in reality it was an English dominion, and Irish political processes were completely controlled out of Westminster, and there were still in existence a very strong set of laws specifically targeting Catholics in Ireland and designed to maintain control, known as the Popery Laws. And over the course of the 18th century, sporadic outbreaks of resentment and rebellion in Ireland were put down, but a gradually increasing sense that actually there was a serious problem began to manifest itself. And of course, as you will know, Ireland ultimately went up in flames in the 1790s, and Wolfe Tone, made a non-trivial attempt to have Ireland invaded by the French, which became very close to succeeding. So, but Burke's approach was always the same, which was he was always on the side of the underdog, no matter how unfashionable the claim might be. And in this case, that meant espousing the rights of the Irish, the rights of the Catholics in Ireland in particular, opposition to the Popery Laws, and a desire to create a richer, more prosperous economy alongside a success, an actual functional political system. And as you know, Pitt made very strong efforts to bring the Irish together with the English, and ultimately succeeded, although not for not without an enormous amount of trouble. So it's a mixed picture, but I think Burke is on the side of the angels.
Okay, so there's a question here.
Dr. Norman, Australians are very grateful to Burke for his vocal opposition to sending the convicts to Africa. Now, from your book, it would seem only Burke's obsession with Warren Hastings saved the Botany Bay project.
It's not quite clear what to say about that. I think Burke's position in the 1780s was absolutely preoccupied in every dimension by India, to the point of obsession. And he'd never visited it himself, but nevertheless, just in a classic Burkean way, by sheer hard work and by setting up a committee and writing various reports and soliciting various bodies of knowledge, he made himself into the house expert on these issues. But that kind of preempted every other, almost everything else he did, and it rather fed the idea which took root in the 1780s that Burke had gone from being an amusing and rather powerful figure on the make to being a kind of distracted and angry irrelevance, a position that was not helped by his views on the king's madness. So the double irony of this is that when you get to the French Revolution, no one wants to believe Burke's view because it's the crazy Burke uttering it, and because everyone would much rather believe that they're great friends and, as it were, salon, dinner table companions are going to be absolutely fine, it's all going to yield. And so then there's this extraordinary moment where they have to, and Charles James Fox essentially has to deal with the fact not only that he's lost his political mentor, but his party has been split in two by his incautious reaction.
As I interpreted the question, is if Burke was around today, would he support Australia or South Africa in the cricket, I think?
Yes, I think that's an issue of politics far too...
There's a question there, and then we come here. Yeah.
I'm also looking for Burke's fingerprints on Australia's founding documents, which are 18 months before the revolution in France. I note that Philip had an instruction that this would be a free country, so there would never be slaves. That the military were to conciliate the affections of the indigenous peoples. And I also note that both Governor Burke, different spelling, and Governor Macquarie were both relatives, actually, of Edmund Burke. And so are you aware of these fingerprints? Am I imagining those fingerprints?
I mean, there are a lot of... unless you have specific evidence that they are relatives of Burke, I would just say there are a lot of Burkes. It's a very common Irish... Yeah, well, I would be interested. There are a lot of Burkes. Now, there are two things to say about that. One was that Edmund Burke and his so-called cousin William, who was no cousin but actually was a friend, William Burke, had written a book on the European colonies in the Americas. And they'd come to the view that there were real differences between the different strands of colonization to be applied by, as it were, the mother countries in each case. And they were quite close to a distinction that we now think of as a kind of extractive approach towards colonies versus a more of a kind of inclusive approach. And what's interesting, if you look at Burke's writings on he wrote notes essentially on the potential regularization of the slave trade, which I think are very interesting, long before, this is 7 or 8 years before Clarkson and Wilberforce get going. And what he says is, as it were, this is something that has to go, and it has to go in a classic Burkean way via reforming the process. As you understand, enormous economic issues involved. It may not have been realistic to think of it being abolished overnight. It didn't get finally abolished for another 55 years or so. But what is striking is how humane the prescriptions that he puts into that are. So he expects processes of law to deal with slaves' disputes, or with he has a notion of the rights of slaves as being properly, in some sense, being respected. He has he's concerned about the well-being and the family life of that. And, of course, these are fantastically sensitive issues today. But what is so interesting is that he was very progressive on this issue before the anti-slavery, as it were, campaign had ever really got going. And Smith... bizarrely, I'm just bringing Smith into the equation, even more so. I mean, Smith had expressed his opposition to slavery on moral and economic grounds in the 1760s, which is astonishing, really.
There's a question here.
Jesse, you mentioned Burke's conception of political parties and his emphasis on that and the importance for representative democracy. To what extent do you think that the... almost extreme development of a professional political class and the drawings of major political parties from members of that class for pre-selection and representation in Parliament, to what extent do you think that imperils truly representative democracy in our modern era?
It's such an interesting question. Of course, it's very... as a voter... I want my elected members to be, full of experience and knowledge, and I want them to bring something to the table. And I was terribly old-fashioned. When I became an MP, I decided I wasn't going to do it before I was 40, and I'd done a bunch of bizarre things. I mean, I'd run a charitable project giving books away in Eastern Europe during the communist period, and I'd run an opera company, and I'd worked on Wall Street, and I'd done a whole bunch of crazy things. But all of which turns out to be incredibly valuable in politics, because politics, when you get into it, in many ways, is a recapitulation of other experience you've had and constantly drawing on it. And financial stuff was enormous. Enormously valuable when I was on the Treasury Committee and grilling some of these characters after the economic crisis of 2008.
But that's unusual.
All I mean to say is, but there is another side to it, which is that if you count out the people who are, in that sense, professional politicians, and let's say people who go into this having done relatively little else before they go into politics. You lose, well, you lose, we probably lose Burke, who had really just been a writer and a literateur. I mean, wonderful things, but not what you might call running a team, running a budget, the kind of things that people might think about when they think of wider experience. You lose Burke, you would lose Pitt, you would lose Churchill, you would lose Margaret Thatcher. You know, you're losing some pretty substantial politicians. So I think we have to be balanced. I think what we have to say is what really matters is that people come into office either, as it were, endowed with experience that would give them real value added, or that they are able to commit themselves in politics to expanding their understanding and their experience in a way that kind of gives them that extra scope and potential for leadership. So I'm not quite as kind of dogmatic in my own cause as perhaps I ought to be with my own background.
Dr. Norman, allied to that, did Burke give any advice as to the maximum number of political parties that should be in a parliament?
Well, I think you understand that the answer to that question is no. Of course, political parties didn't really exist until he invented them. You had very widespread groupings from the time of the exclusion crisis in the 1680s onwards, but you didn't have political parties in the modern sense. The extraordinary, the decisive moment is that after the Rockingham government gets turned out in 1766, everyone thinks, well, the wheel's turned three or four times already in the last 5 years, 6 years, we'll be back in before long. Of course, it's 16 years before they come back. But uniquely, and never, this had never happened before, they do not lose their coherence as a body. They remain united around issues of principle, the restraint of patronage, you know, properly, you know, economic reform, all those kinds of things. And they don't lose their shape. They're not merely factions united around interests. They are political parties united around principle. And when they come back in 1782, they try to, you know, Burke goes to become paymaster general, fails to enrich himself, but unleashes a whole series of attempts to reform the economic system at the time. So that's a kind of epochal moment. You don't get political parties in the modern sense really coming into being across the spectrum in Britain until the early to mid 19th century, and of course you don't get the Conservative Party until Peel in the 1830s and 40s, and that notion, that word conservative, doesn't really exist in British life, and of course the Whigs don't become the Liberals for another 30 or 40 years. Sorry.
Yes, well, I was going to ask you about that, Dr. Norman. Sorry about that.
No, good.
I was going to ask you about that because Burke is presented to us as a conservative figure, but back in the 18th century, the two parties were the Tories, who were the Conservatives, and the Whigs. And, of course, Burke was a Whig, not a Tory. And I was just curious as to what the explanation is of that, thinking in current terms.
Yes, I mean, I think it's a mistake to think of there being parties in the modern sense at that time. You don't, as I've said, you don't really get parties until, in the sense of two duking it out alternatives, until rather later. Don't forget, I mean, and so the fact that Burke is a Whig. I don't think he rules out the idea. In my view, he's a conservative because of what he says. So let's just think about it. Burke's central idea is that we inherit a priceless bequest in the form of society, which it is our duty to preserve and uphold and pass on. So he has a conception of social value as it were, an endowment in the form of society. He speaks of society as a partnership between the living, the dead, and those yet to be born. That is to say, it's not about any one set of individuals. It's not about any particular generation. And these are all deeply conservative thoughts. He's committed to reform rather than to either no change, reactionary politics, if you like, or revolutionary change for the reasons I've described. So in point of doctrine, I don't think there can be any doubt at all, really, that he's a conservative of a, in modern sense, rather liberal kind. And of course, politics at that time, whether you called yourself a Tory or a Whig, was by modern standards extremely conservative. So, and of course, these alternatives of, as I've said, of liberalism or socialism just didn't exist.
Now, we've got a lot of questions coming, so I've got to be brief.
I will be quick in my answers.
Not you, the questioner.
No, well, I'll try to be quick in my answers as well. So,
Minister, if you go back two generations, you'll find there's a long stream where Burke was celebrated for the way in which he marshalled state power to bring down the largest viceroy of his day, Warren Hastings. And that Burke, as a representative of the best values of the system, was that which was celebrated because he acted. It wasn't his reflections and it wasn't his views. Now,
keep going.
I'm sorry, he always interrupts. I just wanted to know why it was that this aspect of Burke has almost completely disappeared, Minister.
Right. Well, so thank you, Dee, for that. I don't accept that. I think you make a fallacious distinction between reflections and actions. Burke saw himself as what he calls a philosopher in practice. And that is to say, the job of politicians is not to be airy-fairy theorists about abstract ideas, absolutely not, but it is to trade off interests which are different from each other in the public square. That's what parleying in Parliament is, right? Some person wants to build an airport today. Some person wants to save the wetland reserve. What do you do? Answer, you take it to a politician and hopefully you get some kind of worked out answer. Now, so Burke's practice is a very reflective practice. That doesn't mean to say he's not prepared to take vigorous action where possible. In the case of Hastings, he was yanking every constitutional lever he possibly could, and that included resuscitating the ancient procedure of impeachment in order to get this guy back home. And Hastings, in many ways, wasn't a bad man. I mean, he was, by the standards of the time, he was an enlightened man, not unlike Burke himself. But the demonstration that private power, as well as public power, should be held public to public account when it affected public benefit in the way that the East India Company was doing. They'd been fighting private wars essentially in India, and then they'd been responsible, as he saw it, for some very, very severe local oppression. That's the principle that Burke's standing for. And what's so interesting is that, you know, he declaims against what he calls a geographical morality. So his view is, very broadly speaking, listen, these people may be different from us, they may practice have different practices, may have a different religion, but they're still, as it were, entitled to our respect and consideration. Indeed, he talks about a Magna Carta for Hindustan. I mean, that's an astonishing thought for the 1780s.
A reasonable complaint, justifiable complaint about today's politicians is that they're all pragmatists without any philosophy. You mentioned Thatcher. Apart from Thatcher and Reagan, they seem to have all disappeared off the political scene. And perhaps embarrassingly, the only one of the few politicians who speaks of what he believes is Jeremy Corbyn. Why do you think politicians these days are incapable of speaking philosophy and just speak to ad hoc?
Well, I hope you won't mind if I say I'm not sure that the person you're describing is giving you philosophy. What I think he's giving you is the received doctrine of the 1960s. This is not a reflective practice in the sense that I'm describing it. I think every politician is under a certain obligation to set out their ideas and the principles on which they act. And many politicians do. There's a tremendous appetite to avoid the highfalutin and the pompous, and I'm extremely respectful of that. But it's very important for there to be political leadership for the politicians in question to explain and to argue and to make the case for what they're doing and to set out a wider encompassing vision that allows people to understand what they are being asked to do and why it fits into a wider, hopefully warm, positive, engrossing and inclusive vision of society. And if we don't have that, then I think we're making mistakes. So I think we have to be talking in those terms, and I think we have to be bringing people with us, and I think that, that is the way you do that. And the very best politicians do do that. And that can be Thatcher, it can be Churchill, it can be Ronald Reagan, it can be Abraham Lincoln, and you know, I'll leave you to decide the Australian,
okay,
or the Australian alternative.
Okay, we're going there, and then we're coming up.
Yes. Hello, ma'am.
Yeah. No, go to speak into the microphone.
Okay. Thank you, Bert.
No, go to speak into the microphone.
Oh, does that come?
Yes.
That's good, yes.
Thinking of Bert as a deep-thinker and a visionary, can you think of a modern equivalent of him in the world generally?
In politics?
In politics or just in the general world, say someone like Mandela, who might have had a total vision of how life should be for everyone.
Well, I think it's very hard to say, but I think a Mandela is, you know, obviously an absolutely extraordinary human being, possessed of a remarkable moral authority, but also a degree of humility and a great personal vision. Another person I would fit into that category, Václav Havel. When I was going out to the Czech Republic many years ago, you know, Havel was a member of the opposition and had been writing seditious plays that set out his very Czech view of the world. And so his transparent honesty and commitment to the cause and his prestige made him the inevitable choice when the Velvet Revolution took place, and they were looking for a new order. And that was in part a function of his, not just his political judgment and vision, but his moral integrity.
Jesse, thank
Hello.
You for coming amongst us this evening. In this part of the world, Australia and New Zealand, during the early 19th century, 1820, 1830, 1840, the Whigs were in the ascendancy in Britain, and their liberal ideas were very much influenced the outcome in New Zealand, which was the Maoris and the British coming together in the Treaty of Waitangi. And I'm wondering if you would reflect on the Whigs and Mr. Burke and those influences and values that were so important here.
I think it's very hard for me to do so in the context of New Zealand's history or Australian history, because I just am not knowledgeable enough about it. But what I will say is that the Conservatives have a, from their side, and very much on Burkean lines, have a tremendous record of social reform in Britain. And people forget that. There's a kind of desire to regard conservatism as a form of reactionary opposition to change at all. Absolutely not. As Burke insists on the need for change. Smith's view, which I take to be a conservative view, is very specifically a view of the evolution of society and markets and moral behaviour within that. These are not revolutionary changes, and they are not static. They are dynamic, unfolding possibilities. And if you look at British history, there is a, you know, you just take the Second Reform Act that was passed by Disraeli, and many of the pioneering pieces of legislation of the 19th century, which we take to be kind of anchors of our modern sensibility, were passed by conservatives. And Beveridge himself, as you will know, was writing for a conservative government and was indeed a conservative, or of a rather liberal stamp. So I think one shouldn't be one shouldn't hand over the thought to, as it were, the Whigs as reformers. Much though I admire many of the Whig politicians of the time.
Big last question, can be very brief.
Thank you, Dr. Norman, for batting very well against a lot of reverse swing tonight.
Yeah, pleasure.
democracy is assumed to being at the unchallenged foundation of all of the arguments that we've heard tonight. The People's Republic of China under Xi Jinping has come out with a set of three different principles which they hope will supplant democracy, and basically meritocracy, as long as you remember the Communist Party, one party effectiveness, and a governing elite to stop the majority from worrying about governing. How would Burke react to that and counter it, given the confusion in philosophy and debate that seems to occur now?
Well, I think the answer to that is very clear, which is, China's an extraordinary country. It is a country that is devoted to one-party government, and therefore it, as it were, fails the basic test of legitimate government by a Burkean standard, which must be that there are political parties, as it were, competing for the affections and the interest and the support of the electorate. But there's a wider problem, which is that why does that matter? I think it matters because of the nature of legitimacy implied by society and commercial society, that is modern society, in its very many forms. And the question of how you preserve legitimacy is of absolutely central importance. And the reason why people are now fleeing to these extremes of nationalization or expropriation or nationalism is because of a worry about what you might call the center, the strong centre of British, potentially Australian politics, being emptied out. Now, that's all very well, but you wait until some of these ideological challenges to liberal democracy start to encounter economic headwinds, because the question will be, what are their sources of legitimacy at that point? Where do those people go when the bread and butter isn't coming on the table at quite the speed it is at the moment? And I think that's a very serious question. And the Chinese governing elites are so intelligent, they undoubtedly understand this and are thinking about it. But the absence of political representation at that point may prove to be a very, very severe handicap.
So finally, just to where you come back, just sure. Where you finished off, Adam Smith, what are you going to tell us in July about Adam Smith that gives us a new way
a
of looking at
of Adam Smith. So nothing you think you know about Adam Smith is true. He's the founder of sociology as well as the founder of modern economics. He is a man the treasures of whose intellectual contributions have yet to be fully plumbed and brought to the surface, and when they are, I think people will be dazzled by them.
Many thanks.
Thank you very much.
We had many more questions that we could be here or not, but I just couldn't get everyone in, but we did a lot of questions. So many thanks to Jesse Norman. As I said, they're copies of Dr. Norman's book. Look, it was a fascinating talk tonight, and we had over 30 minutes of questions, predominantly on Edmund Burke and related topics. So I think it's a real achievement for someone who's a politician, a hard-working politician, a minister in a government who can write such fascinating books as you will, the Burke book, and we would anticipate from the taster also the Smith book. But for tonight, congratulations, well done. We'd love to have you back sometime in the future. But for tonight, that's it, and well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.